Mexico, looking forward to and week here, and thank you very much for coming to my lecture, even though there was no title. And I didn't know the title myself until last night, because I didn't know what I was going to talk about. And I made my decision then after I arrived, and I hope it's a good decision. I would like to talk about proteins with mechanical functions, since cells have mechanical functions. Proteins have mechanical function, because most of what cells are doing is done by proteins. And if you want to do something mechanical, then you have probably sort of like three problems. One is conceptual: what are really the mechanical functions? And then the second is that when you want to do anything mechanical, your forces arise and you have to be able to sustain these forces. So if the forces are too strong, you might break the soft proteins. Proteins are inherently soft, and so we need to know in how far they are made to sustain forces. And then, of course, you would like to go to the heart of the matter. How do you generate those forces, and what are these forces doing to the system? And naturally, to understand how proteins are made to withstand forces is a little bit easier, so I will talk about that first. To understand how proteins generate forces and what forces are doing in terms of signaling is surprisingly difficult. And so I myself put it off for a while, but we dabbled for the first time somewhat successfully into this area. Recently, I want to talk about that. Okay, so first the general, so here are some motions, but we will see all these pictures later. You see there the muscle fiber, and you see this twitching because forces are being generated in the muscle. For example, flight muscle insect moves very quickly, skeletal muscle moves a little more slowly. And this becomes more and more of an issue in biophysics and in biology. In fact, we see that today forces are playing all those roles that that chemicals like reactants and products played in the past decades of physiology. So there we had almost a feeling that all what biology is about is to have a cell that's like a chemical factory that undergoes, that makes all kinds of chemical transformations, and that's what life is. But today we see that forces play the same role. They can be input in chemical reactions, they can be output of input of chemical of cellular processes, output, they can be signals, and just like molecules. And the only reason that this was not realized before is that there was no good way for a long time to measure those forces. But as some of the speakers here have told you already, that today we can observe those forces, particularly also at the single molecule level. And so now finally forces are getting their justice as very important participants in the process of a cell, probably as important as the chemical participants are. We investigated this kind of forces in proteins for a long time, just here to show to beat my chest a little bit, how many simulations we did. Some of it is methodologically a little bit demanding, because these systems that arise in cellular mechanics are pretty big, particularly when you apply forces, they undergo transformations that take a lot of volume, and then you have to give them enough of a space to do it. But we learned a lot from simulations, and some of the results I will show briefly that came from all these calculations. So a good example to start with my first issue, namely how proteins can actually withstand forces, start with muscle. That's not only natural choice because we all know muscle, but it's also quite dramatic choice because the muscle generates lots of forces in parallel and in series, and some of the molecules have to not only withstand local forces but also the sum of the forces that were generated somewhere distant from the particular protein. So these forces add up, and so proteins in muscle have to withstand quite particular forces. We all know muscle, or at least we think that we know muscle. Namely, we know that there are the thick filaments and the thin filaments, and they are the scaffold that make muscle contract. But if this is all you know, then you ignore one particular piece of the muscle. This is the thin piece. That is a third component, also a protein component. It's called titin, and that provides muscle with elasticity and structural stability. You can imagine that you have here like an elastic rubber band that if you pull the muscle, the thick filament out here, it tries to pull it back, and it gives it thereby some kind of elastic property. It also prevents that the muscle gets overstretched, that the thick filament leaves the confinement of the thin filament, and if that happens, then the muscle would be structurally broken. It's not known to be really compressed. This is just a visual picture. I don't know any experiment that tells you that the titin is also a compressive kind of element. So I only know that it is actually something that is being stretched under any conditions that it has been observed. Maybe I don't know everything. It's an interesting point you raise, but I'm not aware of anybody saying. You will see that more because we talk about the attachment. It's attached to the Z line, and I will show this in great. I will focus on the attachment point particularly. So maybe titin is also compressed, but I don't think anybody has voiced this. So here we have this titin. It has been studied by atomic force microscopy. It's actually the longest gene in the human body, and it has 300 subdomains. It is such a big gene that even though we have various type of muscles, it has only one gene in the human genome. But it is then post-transcriptionally modified for the various muscles. This is actually a very interesting way how biology adapts itself to the various needs. An expensive gene needs to be post-translationally modified because you cannot have a gene for every purpose, particularly not such a long one. Now you can take the individual domains out, and you can build tandems of them, like a repeat or 4 or 10, and this is done by various groups, in particular by Julio Fernandez, who started his work with Hermann Gaup in Munich, and has now a wonderful group now at the Columbia University. He puts them there, and then he can stretch between the tip of an AFM and the substrate these domains out, and he sees some unravel. So if he has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, if he had 6 domains, then he would see this signature, 6 break, and the 7 peak corresponds to the separation then of the tip from the thing. We would like to do this in a simulation to understand how this comes about. Particularly, it looks like each domain has a single force peak, that means there's one particular position extension at which the domain is rupturing, and this is what one wants to understand. why is it not like a very broad distribution of various kinds of peaks, but rather a single one that one finds to be always at a particular extension of that protein. And so to do this, I want to show a movie. I hope I find it. I forgot to look for it beforehand. So here you see this. Maybe if you make it a little bigger. So, and here you see the simulation. And so you see we pull at the two ends of the protein, we keep one end fixed, and we pull on the other end. This is one domain in this long tichin. And you see that if we, as we pull, the protein separates and extends. But one can now look at the physical properties along this course of events, and that's what I want to do with you. You see here we plotted as we extend the protein, the force that is needed, and there's then one point where the force is very strong, and then the force becomes much weaker. Apparently this is a rupture point, and then at the very end, if one has stretched out the molecule, the domain, then it becomes hard again. To stretch it further, and so all the what is the forces are too big. That is, we cannot compare the forces because we simulate much faster than the process takes place in atomic force microscope. So that is not what you can compare in the simulation. You have to compare the potential energy. Features, and from that you can deduce then the forces, you can calculate them back to what they would be if you would say if you pull in milliseconds. You can go, but at a huge computational cost, you can go down by slowing down the process. We are pulling in the here in about typically 10 nanosecond domain. If you want to go to the millisecond domain, you have to bridge 5 orders of magnitude, and that's of course not computational possible, but we can bridge, let's say, 2 or 3 of these that we tried, and then we see that the forces become smaller and smaller. Unfortunately, you can derive the law for this decrease, and it's unfortunately logarithmically dependent on the velocity, and so this is not something I want to spend my time with. But of course you need to be sure that this is not fantasy, and so we have some beautiful indication that we are actually seeing the proper process. And I will give you one indication in a moment. Yes.
I just missed a point. What is the environment in which the protein is being pulled? I mean, do you have?
What is a physiological environment? It's a periodic cell, so that we don't have a surface, forces from the water. And we make it big enough that the copies in these periodic cells don't see each other.
And the interaction potentials between the different components are sort of.
There's a big community of people who work on improving the veracity of molecular simulations, and they are developing what are called force fields that are very crude. Mimics of the actual force between atoms, but as we know in physics, often sometimes detail doesn't matter, and so we are pretty fortunate there, because if you look at what force fields people are thinking up, they are pretty primitive, yet they work pretty well. So people are developing them, and when they see that there are problems, let's say that certain molecules are not structurally behaving the way you see them in crystallography, and they improve them, and so they have been now developed over almost 30 years, and we have reasonable force fields. I would say, I stress always, I'm not interested in quantitative details anyway, I'm interested in qualitative effects, and so there are many of them that peak out of the error that you have in the force field.
I guess I I'm unclear on even simpler things. Is it like the end of that famous spring, right, is being pulled at a,
yes.
at a fixed that's position, right, as a function of time?
You put a spring on there and then you pull
the
end.
The force on the
and
spring.
On the spring, that's right.
Right. Okay.
You can also, of course, apply a constant force. That's one way of doing it. You are applying a spring, then you pull the end with a certain velocity. But you can all, you have any kind of scenario that you can easily communicate in a paper. So we also can apply a constant force at the end. So it's always the same force.
No, we do either one.
We do usually only either one because it's easier to communicate in the paper. We either put a constant force or we put a spring at the end and pull it with a constant. This one here, this particular one, had a spring.
Like a constant velocity.
Yes.
Okay, so that's why the high velocity would actually not quite represent
the atomic force
microscope. The force is happening at, say, close to equilibrium.
That's right. Okay. That's right.
If you had a constant force, you would just get the first peak, and that would be the end of the simulation. So that's why constant force is not usually as interesting.
Actually, constant force is usually the better way of doing it, because first you can immediately shoot them close at the experiment, and second, so here we, for example, experiment has a force of about 200 piconewton. We can pull it and get it done, let's say in a week or so, with 500 piconewton. But when you want to explore a system, then it's better to pull. Because then when the system doesn't move, you pull and pull and pull, and if the force becomes too big, you say, it must have pulled in the wrong direction. But otherwise, something happens, you see at which force it happens.
But if the back way is exploring, but
that is why you are an intelligent experimentalist and I'm an intelligent, hopefully, computational biologist. We have to set up our experiments, we have to set up our computing that we hopefully probe what matters in nature. And that you have to be very intelligent, I have to be very intelligent. I cannot give you now a lecture on how I'm intelligent. Here it's very simple. Here we have a very clear reaction coordinate. Titin is being pulled at the ends, and so I assume, of course, maybe the real titin in a millisecond can go really complicated routes to stretch, but I just assume that when the muscle stretches it out, when the atomic force microscope stretches it out, that the force is applied straight and the system goes, the end separates straight. That's my assumption.
Yes, but for example, you say that the scalar forces,
if I pull in the wrong direction, the system could be really nasty to me. So let's say the system always goes through this door. Through that door, we have a barrier of 10 kilocalories, but I pull through that door and I have a barrier of 15 kilocalories. First, in reality, then it would go for both doors. But I would only tell you about one door, the other door I wouldn't tell you about. So that can happen, and nothing I can do about it. You can do experiments, you find wonderful features that look like they agree nicely with what nature does, but you're misled because you're looking in the wrong corner. Now, of course, as a computational biologist, I also carefully check where I can check. Particularly, I like to check before the experiment. And I will tell you a few examples where we checked before the experiment, and so nobody can tell me then, you just agree with everything they measure, so that is a little bit too easy for you. But otherwise, I don't know. So that's... So then let's focus on the peak. So we go now... Oops. Oh, I lost something here. higher here, here, there. So now we go to this peak, we want to look what happens at the peak. So the atomic force microscopists pretty much give you two numbers. They give you the maximum force, and they give you the extension at which this maximum force arises. And you want to learn something about how this all relates to the full structure of the protein. There's no way. So there's really, you might criticize that computational people get into the field, but there's no way of shaking them loose, because the experiment has so dramatically little information that you are making up stories. If you really just go by the experimental numbers, you need to add. And if you want to add the structural information, computing is the way to go. And now we want to check it out. So here we have the peak, and you see over the peak something is happening. What is happening? So I go first about, I just compare here, just the situation before the peak. Here are these cigarettes. They are hydrogen bonds that connect the beta strands of the protein. And here's one actually sometimes forming, sometimes not forming. If you count them all, this one included, and we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and one not visible, there are 9 of these cigarettes. And if you go across a peak, then we shear these cigarettes, these bonds, and very suddenly they all disappear. Here, you see those? You can see actually easily 7 of them, of the 9. You see how they break. Now if you resolve it a little bit, then you see that at this sub-peak, the first 2 break. See there? The first 2 on the left side. There. We are just now before the big peak. And on the big peak, the rest of them break. So here's a clear result that you don't get out of the atomic force experiment. That if we look at the structure and we pull, we see that the forces, the force, the strength, the mechanical strength develops from the need to break a large set of hydrogen bonds at the same time in order to extend the protein further. Now if you continue, then you find that you can now in a zipper-like fashion, look at those hydrogen bonds here, that you can separate them one by one, 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 so they're very easy to break. One hydrogen bond at a time that you can make. So that is result number one. Now can you check it? Yeah, that we did. We suggested this as a scenario to Julio Fernandez. Now I'll go back to my show here. And so here you see the scenario in detail. And so this is before the peak, then the first break, and then the next 3 break, and then the rest break one by one. And so we suggested this to Julio Fernandez, and he had in the meanwhile observed the following, that when he looked at the shapes, the signatures for the breaking the individual domains of the same titin bond, found actually that there was like a hump that became smaller and smaller as he went to the larger, to the later peaks. So here was the first broken, the second domain broken, and so it disappeared. And he could show that this hump corresponds as if there are 2 breaking events that happen at 2 forces, one at a strong force that corresponds to the peak, and one at a smaller force that corresponds to the hump. So these are the 2 peaks that arise from this. And now our suggestion was simply that this lower force is actually coming from breaking just 3 hydrogen bonds, and the bigger, the stronger peak from breaking the next 6 ones. And so we sat together with Julio, and we decided then by making mutations in this part of the protein, we could eliminate these hydrogen bonds, and that we did. And if you do this, then in a paper that we published jointly in Nature, we we could show that the hump here disappears completely when you mutate that part of the protein that is responsible for those hydrogen bonds that we suggested in the simulations. Now they are always competitors, though other people don't quite like this kind of stories. And the competitor in this case was Jane Clark at Cambridge University, wonderful lady, an excellent scientist. But she didn't believe this computing, and so what she did is she had apparently excellent graduate students at Cambridge, and they made 400 mutations all over the protein, whereas with Julio Fernandez we did 3 mutations, and at the end of the 400 mutations they found the same as we found with 3 mutations. So with other words, you can do your own pick. If you say you're purist, you don't want to look at computing, then do your 400 mutations. Or otherwise you might want to take a hint. If they don't work, you can still do your 400 mutations. Now, I want to come back here, and you see you call this beta strands the secondary structure of the protein. Proteins can have alpha helices and beta strands, and we see that the particular elasticity that arises here comes through the secondary structure. So I like to call it therefore secondary structure elasticity. That is what gives these particular domains the extensibility. There's more to tie it in than this particular elasticity, but as far as the single domains are concerned, it's a secondary structure elasticity. So now I come to that connection point of the titin filament, which is drawn here in a somewhat misleading fashion. So the real, we have here the actins, and then we have the thick filaments, and they are connected straight away with the titin, but since there's not enough space to draw a little detail, we drew the titin off to the side. And so you see there are many, many domains of titin. A few of them have been structurally solved and investigated. And I would like to now come to that exciting place, the question, what holds the titin fixed, what anchors it in order to give it the ability to be put under strain. And this happens in the so-called Z line. This is this line here. And we don't know what this line is exactly made of. It contains large complexes of protein. But we know for sure that the titins end up here. So you see they are very thin here, so you cannot really recognize them well. They're not resolved, but they end up here. And the suggestion was made that they are actually pairwise, knot themselves to the Z-line. How they did it was not clear, but an interesting suggestion was made through a crystallographic structure that was solved in the laboratory of Matthias Willmans at the Embel laboratory, an outstation of Embel at Hamburg. It's an accelerator there. And they got the structure of a protein, namely teletonin, that has a tendency to make a complex with the ends of 2 titin molecules. Here's titin, and the last domains are called Z1 and Z2. Because of Z-line, you number the first 50, Z1, Z2 to Z50. And so you see one titin brings Z2, Z1, the other one brings Z2, Z1, and titin is a glue that glues the two together. And that was suggested by the crystallographic structure, but it could have been that the structure that was seen might have been more an artifact of crystallization or of biochemistry. So we probed it for its mechanical strengths. So here you see the architecture of the protein. You see here the teratonin. You see here from one titin and from a second titin, the D1 and D2 domains, and they interdigitate nicely. But if you look at the architecture, then you see that this protein, this complex, this glue, is actually extending the notion of secondary structure stability or elasticity, in that the titin is connecting itself to the other proteins through a set of hydrogen bonds. Initially, there were only intra-strand hydrogen bonds in the domain that I showed you, but here we have inter-protein hydrogen bonds. We have also the same kind of hydrogen bonds between the titin and the teletonin, between teletonin and the second. And so this just...
So I think the answer is no. So there are no covalent bonds between.
No covalent bonds. And so we can just pull on this thing, and you see how it Nanman puts it all in the computer, and one can pull on the Z1, Z2 individually as a pair, or as at the two ends here, and interesting enough, even Z1, Z2 by themselves are of course stable, but they can be pulled apart through the application of force, but the force you need without the teletonin present is much weaker than when you pull the entire domain apart. That means that the teletonin is not only just barely gluing the titin ends together, it even gives the ends more stability than they have by themselves. And so we have here then another theme of the secondary structure idea, that secondary structure elasticity and stability idea, that it's not only important to give intrinsic proteins intrinsic elastical properties, but it's also means of gluing proteins together. This looks like a fabulous invention by nature, but it's actually also a dangerous one, because as you know, maybe when you saw your child getting hold of the glue while you were out, glue can also be doing bad things. And so we know that several central nervous system diseases are connected with the same kind of gluing together of proteins that naturally rise in cells, and that are then forming plaques in cells, and because they are gluing themselves into macroscopic bodies, and this is a dangerous thing, which invites me to the question, how does nature prevent the teletonin from gluing to the wrong proteins? How is it delivered so that it's not starting to glue before its time, that it just glues the right thing?
I'm sorry, I missed the point. Is the initial structure from crystallization? Or
this structure is from crystallization, yes.
Okay.
We have also this, just the pair was also from crystallization. So now I would like to tell you about a protein that is that shows a different type of elasticity. This protein is called uncarin. It's a famous protein for the reason that it is actually one of many proteins of its type that are being discovered and studied presently, a so-called repeat protein. It is made of many repeats that are not identical. They're pretty close, but not quite identical. And this type of proteins arise in many instances in living systems. And in case of uncarin, we find that it arises, for example, as a connector between the cytoskeleton of cells and mechanosensitive channels. These channels by themselves have not been structurally solved yet, but from sequence we know that several of the mechanosensitive channels in mammals have uncarin termini. We know that these uncarin termina have a tendency to connect themselves through yet other tertiary proteins with cytoskeleton.
So
Is it possible for you to make a sketch anyway on the board or something of how you imagine that Ankrem talks to the channel? Like when I talked to Corey a few years ago, I was asking about these pictures where people sort of almost imagine a lid being opened off.
The current thought is the same, but we are waiting for the structure of the first TRP channel to be solved. So the channel to which Ankrem adds itself are the trip channels, and no group yet has achieved crystallized channels. They belong to the G protein receptor family of channels, which have a high they're very important in pharmacology. So many people tried to crystallize those, and that didn't succeed either. The only G-protein double receptor that was solved is bacteriorhodopsin and rhodopsin, but no other one yet. So until we know this, we don't really. But the idea is simply that the Ankrem turns out, as I show you data-wise a little later, is a very sensitive spring, and so it the cytoskeleton could easily pull on it, and then really like open a lid, open ion channels, and then signal to the cell that there was some mechanical strain. So here you see how the protein is being extended. It also relaxes it by itself back. You see here the data. You see here different snapshots, and you see here that the protein is actually helical. We cannot see that from the side so well, and we just have a helix, like a bed spring that we stretch out, just like we stretch out a helical spring. Now this was actually a very interesting case in the history of computational biology, because when Ankrem was discovered, the structure became available, then it just happened that both atomic force microscopists and computational biologists got interested in the system at the same time, and there was a race. Who characterizes Ankrem first? And in this particular case, it was a very difficult calculation. It wasn't easy for us, but we still won. We published our paper in 2005, and in 2006 appeared two papers that did atomic force microscopy experiment, and that agreed remarkably with two predictions of the calculations. First, what are the forces necessary to extend for basically what is the Young modulus of the protein? What are the forces necessary to extend it? Let's say the angstrom.
Experiments or
the experiment appeared? This is the best experiment regarding this measurement, and this will be another one. They didn't quite get the same, they don't have a disagreement, but they saw a different feature of it, they didn't get the same. They knew that they were coming out, and so that they rush out the paper so that they didn't lose their shirt. But it's not disagreement between them, but they couldn't quite measure as much as.
No.
These are theoretical calculations. I just only show you this line and that it goes, because I didn't want to make this the main part of the lecture, because the data cannot be compared. You cannot put there the experiment and there the calculation, because you need to interpret the data. So I would have to talk 5-10 minutes, and I didn't want to do it. But the paper cite this paper, they cite very prominently the theory as being in agreement with what they thought. Oh, we have different types of, sorry that I should have just done one, but we have different types of Ankrems, like with 12 repeats, with 24 repeats, and so there are different simulations.
But the idea is that these are equilibrium
quota equilibrium, but yes, that's right. Yes.
Mm-hmm. There's no velocity dependency.
No. Here the forces that we see in this particular case agree very well with the experiment in this case. So my feeling is that, you know, this is, I will call it, I think it was used already the phrase, I call it tertiary structure elasticity. You change the overall shape and apparently much less friction is involved in doing that. So even though we do this again at 10 nanoseconds, we observe much more agreement with the experiment. This is our first paper, so we didn't have an opportunity yet to see the scaling and think about it, but here we were very fortunate.
Maybe what I was asking, but what's confusing is that in the case of Titan, mm-hmm. you said you couldn't make the direct comparison between the forces and the experiment. So I guess that's what I'm.
Yeah. So in any case where we are pulling a system along a microscopic reaction coordinate, which is what we do when we are shearing these strands, it's like a little bit of a pretty large. Motion, but whenever we do it in part of the protein or part of a reaction event in a protein, we know we have the problem that we cannot compare forces. Here for the first time we do a simulation where we are changing the shape of the protein.
So in the movie you're showing us actually, these ones
they don't agree again.
Okay.
Yeah, we don't agree. Here we also have a secondary structure feature coming in, and these ones here, they calculate the force, and they have the same story as with other ones.
So basically,
but the shape, it seems to be, I'm actually surprised about it, because the shape also has to work against the water, and so there should be some hydrodynamic friction, but apparently that is a much smaller term.
Here, you've got some gentle conformation. It's more like an elastic deformation with no big energy barriers.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Like a mechanical body. It's a.
Can this protein withstand a torsional load?
Actually, that's a very interesting point. And we think we have one data yet to understand. And we think that the protein might unnaturally wind, and that there's a torque applied. And there's one feature in this experiment that we just don't address here, that we didn't see. We don't see, so we have to do simulations a little bit further than we did. And we cannot understand it if we keep the protein oriented. We don't get it. But we hope, or somehow we have some reason to believe that when we include the rotation of the protein, that might give rise to that feature. Okay, so we have secondary structure elasticity, we have tertiary structure elasticity. These are both situations where proteins are passive participants in mechanobiology. And we have been working in my group for more than 10 years on ATPase, which is a very dramatic protein system that involves forces. Either it uses a torque that is generated through a potential energy gradient to synthesize ATP, or uses ATP to generate that torque. And we were, even though we published a few papers, we were very, very unsuccessful. And to really develop from our calculations any other system. I was very depressed about it, but there was only one moment. Actually, my students were more depressed than I, because they were the one where the thesis didn't work out so well, and that the project took a very long time. But my depression got a little bit ameliorated when I heard in January in Japan. Professor Kinoshita, a big, great expert on ATPase, talked about his work, summarized 20 years of work, and he says, we don't understand peep about how the system works, meaning how we getting a coupling between the chemistry of ATP hydrolysis and the rotation of the torque that generates the torque, how this actually works. And so, other people didn't make it either. But now I'm in much better spirit, and the idea was that we did something what one should have probably done much earlier, and to not immediately go for the big guy, the ATPase, even though it's a very ubiquitous protein, very famous, but one should never be misled by important, relevant, but rather by what is really doable. And it's much better to study a small system. And so the system that we begin to investigate, and my colleague Teki Pa, with whom we closely collaborate on the system, will talk a little bit about it, but from the experimental side on Wednesday, is are helicases. Now, some helicases are literally like ATP, also hexameric, and also pretty big, and what they do is they translocate along single-stranded DNA and cleaning it off any proteins that try to begin to digest it, thinking that single-stranded DNA should never be in a cell, but of course at a certain moment it has to be there, and then also pushing against the place where the double-stranded DNA still exists, unwinding the two strands. And now this is of course a motor. It uses a helicase, use ATP to translocate along the single-stranded DNA. This one is not much easier than the ATPase, but there is one helicase that acts as a single domain, like 1/6 of this one, and that helicase is called PCRA. And so we felt that maybe this helicase gives us an opportunity to make more inroads into what is really the key aspect of force-generating devices that use usually chemical energy to generate the force. The key aspect is a coupling between the chemical event and the mechanical event. And so maybe with this one we can understand it. So we have a crystal structure. Actually, we have two crystal structures of this protein with ATP bound, as here, and without ATP bound. And so we are, in a way, in a perfect situation for applying our computational approach. Now, there is one other piece of good news in regard to dealing with the system, and also to know what we learn from it may be actually of wider relevance, and that if you compare ATP, the beta subunit of ATPase, that is the key subunit where ATP is hydrolyzed or synthesized in ATPase, with the subunit that binds ATP in PCRA, then you find that they agree very nicely. Here you see the two structures, you see they are compared quite well. The color coding tells you where it's golden, it's good agreement, where it's blue is very crummy agreement. They agree very nicely, even though the sequences of the proteins do not agree very well. So they have a sequence homology, but a very low one. But the structures agree very well, particularly when you have a closer look. You see then a little bit closer look even, you see that everything that you find in ATPase, you also find in PCRA. I think in the next view graph I even show you now the key binding sites of ATP in PCRA and in ATPase, and you see here you have two arginines, and you have some other key groups that are all up to the atomic detail almost the same in both systems. So the systems do, of course, different things. One is a linear motor, the other one is a torque generator, but both use ATP hydrolysis, and so what we learn from PCRA might be of relevance also to the other systems. The first thing we did, which didn't teach us too much, but a little, and it's definitely an honest starting point for dealing with the system, is we did a quantum chemistry calculation of the reaction that hydrolyzes ATP in PCRA. I told you that we did previously unsuccessful work on ATPase, but this particular work we did also in ATPase, and we found that when we did the calculation, that there was a very remarkable agreement in the mechanism between the two reactions. Not complete identity, but very remarkable agreement. Oh, we cannot know. We just would like to know, in this case, in a way we calculate the rates, because what these calculations are about is what you call the catalysis. You need to have low barriers between 10 and 20 kilocalories to have a process generally occur in on a millisecond time scale in which they occur. So in this regard, we calculate rates, but we don't calculate the real rate number, but we just show that the barrier for the reaction is low. And this is actually what you see here. See that if the reactant, you have the product, then you have a barrier of 20 kilocalories, and that is considered to be a barrier that can be overcome in the millisecond catalytic step. Whereas if you use a wrong reaction or other reaction mechanisms, extra wood, the barriers are 30 kilocalories, 50 kilocalories, and so on. So basically, we found one route with 20 kilocalories that was similar to the low energy route that we found in ATPase, and similar to the catalytic mechanism that had been postulated on the basis of experiments, particularly on experiment on RAS by Wittinghofer, and so there's from the ATP work we knew that this is very likely the mechanism, and so here we find the mechanism. The mechanism involves, the chemist would tell you.
The color schemes, light blue is carbon, and dark blue is nitrogen, and red is oxygen
and yellow is phosphate, and green is magnesium, and white is hydrogen. So the chemists tell you that the water makes a so-called nucleophilic attack, and that makes a new bond with a phosphate atom, then gives up the bond with a second phosphate atom. This is the third, the so-called gamma phosphate, makes the bond. This is how the chemist would say it, because that's how you read it in the textbooks. But this reaction mechanism is way too high in terms of the energy barrier that you experience. This energy barrier is about 40 kilocalories, and we learned both in this system and in the ATPase that actually a second water is involved. This water is attacking, but you need a proton transfer to make this reaction happening, and that proton is being given from this water to this water and then added to this side. And so we have a two water mechanism of hydrolysis, and that was also suggested by Wittinghofer and Goody in Germany, experts on the RAS system, where we have a GTP hydrolysis, and actually on a few other researchers on ATPase. And so this was then found in ATPase, and is again found in the system. And so the five groups then are very much involved in holding the water in such an arrangement that this particular two water attack works well. Now you need two other ingredients for the reaction, and these are arginines. This arginine position is controlling the reactant energy. So by moving it around, you can lower this one so that it becomes, for example, an exothermic reaction. So this particular crystallographic structure that we saw here has this arginine not yet optimally placed for the reaction. The reason could likely be that in order to make a crystal with ATP, you cannot really bind ATP because that would immediately hydrolyze. You have to use a compound that changes, that modifies it such that hydrolysis doesn't take place. And that is likely leading, because you have chemical modification, it's leading that is likely leading to change of this position. This arginine here is called the arginine finger. It acts like a spark plug for the reaction. It is moving in and out in ATPase and in RAS, and RAS is a signaling protein, and so you need to bring it in order to lower the barrier sufficiently. So this happens in ATPase, that comes actually from one of the alpha subunits of ATPase, and when it comes close enough through a geometrical conformational change of the protein, then you bring it close in, and then you can very well control the moment at which this reaction barrier is low enough so that you can do the reaction. While most of the reaction site in PCIA is exactly like in ATPase, we have two differences. We have one difference between these two. This group comes from the second the PCIA is a single domain protein, but it has two subunits. One is called 1A and one is called 2A. And this comes from the 1A subunit. This is a 2A subunit, it comes from 1A. In ATPase, it comes from the alpha unit, and this comes from the beta unit. In PCIA, both of these arginines come from the other domain. So these fingers are being put by the other domain, whereas in ATPase, one is in place and only one of the fingers goes in and out. So it looks a little bit like we have even more geometrical control of the hydrolysis reaction. A second group that differs in nature from the binding site of ATPase is this group. And that group is a very, very interesting group because only two side groups further down, it makes direct contact with the key group of single-stranded DNA. And so this looks like it's a signaling element that tells the system what the single-stranded DNA is doing. Now, from a physics point of view, who is not interested in the chemistry, I think two things should be learned from this. One is that we have through domain to interdomain motion an exquisite opportunity to decide when hydrolysis takes place. When the domains move together sufficient enough, then the barrier is low enough and the hydrolysis occurs very rapidly. So it's more like we have control over the timing of the reaction. The energetics, the protein takes pretty much care of. That's not our physicist's problem. Our physicist's problem is more understanding how the system organizes itself, is that we have a good potential for coupling the hydrolysis reaction as such to events that go on outside. And we have an interesting, but I have to admit, not yet completely understood feature that we have this Q amino acids in direct control of what is happening at the single-stranded DNA. Okay, so this is the sort of what we learn from the actual reaction event. So this is how you can. One of the themes that are really at the heart of doing molecular dynamics simulations, and that will become here important too, is that what these simulations can do, what other experimental methods cannot do so easily, except crystallography, but they only get the static structure, they don't see the dynamics, is we can relate anything we do to structure. So I will end up with models that are not too far away from, for example, a model that Frank Jülicher would, for example, describe to you, and he did probably a week or two ago. But the difference of our work is that because we come from the molecular dynamics field side, where we have to really be very honest to ourselves, we have to put a complete model into our calculation. We cannot leave anything out because the protein is unstable, or we cannot rearrange things improperly because then things clash and the energy is too high and the system explodes rather than moving gracefully. We have to be completely honest, putting all the structural detail in, and as a result we can report on what structure can actually do to the system. So here we don't want to push it so far because we are not really so far yet in understanding the reaction event as such. But I can tell you already here a typical result that we can see what amino acids are involved, for example, in controlling this energy barrier, because we just calculate the energy contribution here and here of all the amino acids, and then we take the difference, and here we see that there are few amino acids that clearly stick out in contributing, whereas others don't. That could lead to suggestion of mutations, but particularly also it guides your thinking about mechanism. Yeah, but this is arginine finger. That is, you take your spark plug out of your car and put in a chewing gum. And you can do that, but...
Yes, but so this is the prediction.
Yes, absolutely, yeah, of course, yes. We love. Oh, this one has been checked many times. This is a very famous group in signaling proteins. And without this group, they don't work. Oh, I checked already. The answer is, you know, some of them we can relate in the literature, they have been mentioned, but I talked to you here about some very recent work, and so this is actually just submitted the paper, and so, you know, it will take some time. Maybe we can ask Tekip if he wants to do it. We worked with Tekip. We worked with him on other mutations. We worked with him actually maybe so that you realize that we completely live your spirit. When we started to do the project with Tekip, we said, you know, like this, I'm the last one to not admit that you have to be very careful in checking simulations. So we said, what should be our goal? And our goal was not supposed to be understanding. Our goal is the following, that we want to suggest a mutation that reverses the translocation direction of PCRA. So one knows that helicases can be some move to the 5' prime end, some move to the 3' prime end, and the differences between them don't look huge, so it doesn't look like there's no chance in doing that. And so our goal is clearly that at the end of this exercise, we will tell Tekip these mutants might reverse the direction of the PCRA. So that's what we want to do. Actually, by the way, we succeeded remarkably in many of our projects in doing similar feats, like, for example, calculating structures that were then crystallographically resolved and so on. So I love this kind of contests. And with the PCI, I don't want to say that we will be successful, but in other cases, we are successful, and that it makes me very comfortable in shrugging off a lot of critique of our work, because, you know, it works. You know, we could do things that people didn't know. We did it, maybe for the wrong reason, but we did it. And so what more do you want? And so I'm a Westphalian farmer, I'm not a philosopher, but if the crops grow, they grow, and more I don't want to know. So now comes actually a big step in where we really learned, or we really followed our approach from what was suggested before by physicists. They had been talking about motors, and maybe this moment I stop quickly. I might actually show you this. They said that if you want to make a motor, you actually will not need like molecular levers, where this pushes against this, against that, and then you have a motor. But you can actually make a motor like a Brownian motor, where you really control the motor action in a very different way, namely at a ratchet. Now, probably many of you know what a ratchet is, but there's this really beautiful example of a ratchet at the website of the University of Basel. And so here you see a series of beads that carry out random motion in this potential that, however, is changing periodically from this tilted ratchet-like potential to the flat potential. So if I push here the start button, then you see how now the potential is flat, and then it's tilted flat, so the expert probably know this, but if you don't, it's really great to see. So you can just through random motion, you can get a motor. And now you can even add a little load here. You see that? So if I add just a little load, you see how much load. See, if I add a lot of load, then the thing cannot quite make it. But if I add a little load, then the system can even work against the load. Now the point is now for me as a computational biologist is that this process, this random process, are pretty genuine to the time scale of the motor. These are processes that take place in the millisecond. They are way beyond what I calculate. And so I should really not try to think I can calculate a motor from the nanosecond to the millisecond. I should think in terms of a stochastic model for the motor that involves a ratchet, and where I can only contribute from the simulation the how far this kind of ratchet motion is consistent with the atomic level detail. That's very important, because it's very easy to make these kind of models, but the trick really to understand motors is to relate these kind of ratchets in real detail to the atomic level, but then you need this ratchet idea. And so that is basically what we are after. So now, the idea is very simple, the following. I can show you already what the idea is. That was already voiced by the crystal of the solar structure. My two hands are two subunits of PCIA. They bind to the single-stranded DNA, which is this stick. And now, when we bind ATP, the domains like to go together. You see that in the crystallographic structure. You know that also from other ATPases. They go together, they go apart. They go together, they go apart. They go together, they go apart. So you don't get translocation. But you can get translocation very easily if you start like this. And now you say, when I bind ATP, I reach a state where this domain is very mobile and this domain is not so mobile. Now when I bind ATP, this goes here. Now, if you now say that when ATP is leaving, I have the opposite thing. This one becomes more mobile, and this is rigid, then this one will go away. And so you go. And so this is a key idea to think about, that what ATP binding and unbinding is really controlling is the mobility of the domains. And so here we make two points about this fact. We have here the ATP bound state, we have here the ATP free state. And now what we simply do is, you see here the DNA, double-stranded, one strand goes there, we cut it off, the other strand goes through here, same here. And now what we do is, we pull on this strand, and we see how easy it is. And we find, in fact, that for one domain we need stronger forces to pull it than for the other domain. And if we go to the ATP unbound form, there are two crystallographic structures, it's the opposite. One other domain is harder to move than the green one. There. I think I had movies here. You know, let me think. Actually, I want to show you the movies because they are really quite cute. So let me do that too. I don't know which one is which, but you see how we pull the DNA. And so here you see these are the DNAs here. Here these are the bases, and you see sort of how we stretch it slowly. And
so can you explain when you say you pull in the simulation, what are you pulling on?
In this case, we pull on all the bases at the same time. It's a connection point to the backbone. So we pull on the basis, and which basis we pull on is shown is shown here, I think. Oops, sorry. How do I get my... Here, see. So here we have our basis. Oh no, this is the next slide. Sorry. So here you see the basis and how they're oriented. Some of them are up and some of them are down. And we pull here in the red curve. We pull the red ones. On the green, we pull the green ones. So just the ones that are in contact with the one domain, we pull. These are the green ones. And then we pull the ones that are close to the red domain, and we just pull them by a little bit, like by about two spacings of the DNA. And so you see
how hard it is to slide the single strand.
Yes. That's right. And we did then another calculation where we calculated for each of the basis, the interaction energy with the domains. And then we used a spline function to sort of like have a smooth energy profile through these energies, because now we want to pull it through this energy landscape that we generate this way. So we calculate these energies, and now we are pulling, if this was a beat of a string of beats, we pull it along. And then we are getting, for the red ones, we're getting the low energy barrier, and for the green ones, we're getting a high energy barrier. Then we recalculate these energies and again make a smooth curve through it, and we're getting then this profile. The profile, it looks like very, very arbitrary to put this curve through there, but you find that the barrier here depends mainly on the energy differences between them. And if you have sort of like a high energy difference situation, then it's harder to pull than when everything is very flat. And so it doesn't really depend too much on this curve, except of course there might be a big barrier here and we just didn't get it and then it wouldn't work. But if you assume that it's a reasonable smooth course, and you calculate now these interaction energies, then you can also predict a change. And the suggestion is simply that in the two binding situation, in the two states of the protein, ATP bound and not bound, you have different mobilities of the DNA due to this interaction between the DNA and the protein. So this just shows that the barriers that you get here calculated from these energies depend on the energy differences. These are the binding energies that we calculate locally, and they depend on these energy differences.
And what's the difference between A and B?
A and B.
Two panels.
What, sorry, what is A and what A and B? I don't know what you mean by A and B.
What's the difference between the two?
One is ATP bound and one is not ATP bound. Now I should know which one is which. I know this one is ATP bound and this one is without ATP. So then we put this system, the DNA moving along the domains, and the domains changing their state of binding ATP, hydrolyzing ATP, and then losing the ATP. We put it into a stochastic a model of a stochastic differential equation that we actually assume strong friction limit and something neglect in Russia term. And we have then a potential energy that is accounting for the energy feature that I described. Yeah, the friction is very important. We just assumed here the friction of a protein of this particular size, even though it's just moving locally. That was a very poor choice, but that was a better one. So that, of course, only determined on the time scale. So the real issue of all these arguments is really the time scale. The time scale of this motion, of the hydrolysis reaction, of the release of the thing. So you really usually don't have to get it only right within the factor 10, 50 or something. So factor 2 doesn't really matter. But if you're off if you're off by that factor, then of course it's could be misleading. So then we put this all together into a model. I show you some of the more detailed rates that we assumed there later. But we monitored then how these domains move along the DNA. Going the negative direction means going to the left side towards the 5' end where the double-stranded DNA needs to be separated. And you see you go down, you see that the single and double domain just move the way I described to you here with this tick. So you can put all into the model, and here you see this is actually a solution of this equation where these two guys here are the domains, and you see how this potential is switching just like in a redshirt between the two states. And so this is just...
2 SI units connected.
Excuse me?
How are the 1A and 2 SI units connected by a spring?
They are, that's a very good point. Here they are being only connected through two conditions. They cannot separate more than when one set of minima, so this one cannot go here, and this one cannot pass the other one. Otherwise they are not, could not, there's no mechanical force between them. And in the next example, so we calculated two models. In the next model, we actually put a spring between them. That was a stiff spring when ATP was bound. So then we say that the ATP pulls the two together, whereas when ATP is unbound, the spring became the opposite, also stiff, but pushed things apart again. So one time we had an interaction term between the two, and one time we didn't. In both cases, it actually works.
Well, they still interact. You just have a hard wall keeping them.
Yeah, but that, of course, they are in the protein. They are pretty confined. So they have geometrical constraints. It's reasonable. So they interact, but they cannot separate more than, I think, 10 angstrom or something. So you can put it all together. And now you see that this one is a random process. You can describe it also by kinetic equations, where the states that are involved in this diagram that I showed earlier, you're getting state 1, 2, 3, 4, and then you're getting the same state here, just translationally moved, and that gives rise to the kinetic diagram that is shown here, and here are some of the reaction rates that tell you what we assume for the hydrolysis reaction, for the release of the product and so on. And we have then this model for one time where we have the interaction between the two, and this one is where we do not have an interaction between the two domains. And we can calculate now, we can put this whole set of transitions, kinetic transitions into rate equation, where these are transition fluxes between the states that are labeled here. This is how the transition fluxes are defined through the probabilities. The probabilities are the probabilities to be at any place. we assumed that we have an infinitely long system. So we have here an probability vector that's actually an infinite vector, but we can, you know, formally put it into this kinetic equation. This is a solution vector. But we are really only interested in the stationary solution, where we now assume that after relaxation time, the system becomes translation invariant. And then we actually only have to solve a 4x4 problem. So if you want, we know these four probabilities, we know them all, because this is exactly the unit that repeats itself. We're getting then a rate matrix here with a stationary probability that we need to solve. And we did. Actually, you can do it in Mathematica. And if you do it, then you can calculate the velocity for the translocation. And you find that the velocity of the translocation is given by a positive factor times the combination of these rate constants that I wrote earlier in my table. And these rate constants are rate constants that appear here in this diagram that depend on the barriers of this potential that I calculated earlier. And we are getting here a positive factor, meaning then a negative velocity moving towards a 5 prime. And if our barriers have this ratio, that they are these potentials, I reproduce this equation in my next diagram, where these are these energies that you where you need to obey this this ratio, and you see what kind of binding energies we need in order to make sure that the system is moving in the right direction. And now we can ask ourselves the question, which side groups contribute to this, and which side group could make reverse the direction. That means that you have to change both signs. If you are changing just one sign, you're getting sort of like a crummy system. It still would probably have a preferable direction, but it's not very robust. But if you change both signs, then you could make the system reverse the direction. And that is, as I explained earlier, to Professor Ben Simon, that is what is really the question that we ask ourselves. Can we identify the side groups that control the direction of the translocation? And so I want to finish by just putting in what we call our favorite model. Our favorite model starts with domains far apart. And we have no ATP bound here. And you see here our Q side that interact with ATP. And you see here the side groups, that is the base that is in close contact with this Q side through this loop here. This is a close contact. And now when we bind ATP, we think that we have really a rather strong force between the domains that pulls the domains together. We have a spring, and then the domains move together, bring into place these arginine side groups. They're being brought in closer proximity. In the meantime, at this moment, we have bound the ATP. So at this moment here, we bind the ATP. The domains attract them each other. Then these arginines move close to the gamma phosphate of the ATP, and then we hydrolyze the ATP. With hydrolysis, so they are still close together, that hydrolysis then leads to the loss of ADP and phosphate to the system. Then the system is changing into action. We assume for the separation, however, for reasons that are more like from discussion with our biology friends, that we do not have a repulsive force, that we just have a neutral system, the system just randomly move apart and go then back to the initial situation here, except 1/1. So we have sort of like one favored model for this system. And I might now summarize my lecture. And the summary goes as follows, that yes, forces play an important role, mechanical processes play an important role in biological cells. They haven't been investigated before because there was no means of looking at events that that involve forces from the experimental point of view or from the experimental side. We can do this now, but the experiments very often, while they are very sensitive to the forces and can detect them, they are not sensitive to the structure. They don't give you a structure picture. Now, I think it's very fortunate, maybe some of the experimental practitioners don't see it quite that way, that at the same time that we could measure forces, we can also simulate the systems. We have a lot of crystallographic information, we have computational methods, and they permit us to connect the experimental observation with atomic force microscope, optical tweezers, and so on, with the structural information. Calculations will probably never, in complex systems as biological systems are, replace the experiment, but they can nevertheless, if you judiciously apply them and interpret them and test them, give you lots of useful information, particularly insights and pictures that you might not have otherwise, and suggestions. So then we followed this obvious route to first describe the passive role of proteins. I just showed you two examples, one of the domains of chitin and one of the the protein uncleurin. We have many more examples, and particularly I didn't choose them to convince you that the method is any good. I could have chosen the examples more by where did we really agree with the experiment or went ahead of experiment. I just sort of like did it more what was relevant from the biological point of view. And then I told you that the real problem, however, is to understand motors, the devices or generators that use forces or generate forces. And I felt personally, I feel personally that it's a very tough problem. Many people describe them, but very often you have descriptions that where you put in almost as much or as much as you get out in terms of ideas. And I rather like approaches where I first look carefully at systems without preconceived assumptions, looking and building into the modeling carefully all the structural details. And that didn't work too well on ATPase, so I had to admit. But now we have PCRA, a very simple helicase that is that looks like it is very it is have great homology, surprising homology to ATPase, but because of its much simpler nature, it might give us a better chance to understand it more completely. And I told you, however, that we have really a problem, that we have to connect basically three levels of biological spatial and time scale, the level of the chemical reaction, that we the electronic level, the level of the elementary dynamic events, the nanosecond, maybe microsecond level, and then the millisecond level on which the process actually takes place. And we really have to know that these are levels that maybe in one distant future we have the supercomputer that makes it all happen in front of our eyes, and we don't even have to think, we just push a button. But at the moment, these are domains that are living quite independently. They have their own concepts and their own life in a way. Yet we should try to connect them, and maybe by connecting them in one unit, going from the from the reaction all the way to the functional domain, we might actually contribute as theoreticians and as computational researchers something to the solution of this amazing of these amazing systems, namely what is really the mechanism, the physical mechanism that underlies the motors, what is really the trick that nature developed. I believe personally that nature is usually doing things simple because it needs to have a robust solution. In this regard, I'm quite sure that we are on the right track with PCRA, that what really is only, not only, but what's really key part of the solution is really the differential mobility that is being realized in the system. They have one time in one state, have one side be more mobile and more moving along the DNA, and the other time the other side more mobile and moving along the DNA. If you couple that then with relative motions of the domains, you have it made. And so in this regard, I find it such an attractive and clear and simple and robust way of controlling a motor function that I'm presently betting my last 10 years as a professor in Illinois on trying it out. I prepared this lecture only between when I arrived here and now, so I didn't prepare the most important part, which is acknowledgement. And so you are sure that all the work was done by my young colleagues at home, but at least I want to tell you their names. So on the Titan, the work was done by Mu Gao. He was a student, a graduate in my group. He's now a postdoc. Then the work on teletonin was done jointly with him and with Eric Lee, who is a graduate student in my group. There was a collaboration with Matthias Wilmans and his students in Hamburg. The work on anchoring was done by Marcos Sotomayor, a graduate student in my group. It was also part of a collaboration with David Corey at Harvard University. And the work on PCRA, on the helicase, was done by Yin Yu, a graduate student in my group, together with Markus Dietrich, a graduate student and postdoc in my group, who just moved to the University of Pittsburgh to become a systems biologist. This is a collaboration with T.K. Parr, whom we are going to tomorrow, and I'd like to thank you very much for your attention.
From this model, you should be able to predict the force velocity relation of PCRA, right? If you apply a force on the DNA, say how it moves, what the stall force is.
With the kinetic model, absolutely, yes. Yes, on color, on this. In the kinetic limit of the millisecond limit, yes. Yes, so we should predict is at this moment a little bit too much of a word, because basically we are more at the level where we see in how far this particular model is consistent with the atomic level detail. So I didn't talk about, you know, how is it also consistent with controlling the hydrolysis reaction, the release of ADP and PI. But it's all like we only see certain consistency, but we assume particular parameters, and on those
we can add a law, absolutely, yes. What's important to get mobility out of this is that this state and this state be occupied in a manner not consistent with thermal equilibrium. And because it's not enough to have a mobility that depends on conformation.
No, absolutely. That is where you spend ATP.
Right, so in this model, I mean, if you put some toy version of this, in which there was an equilibrium between the ATP bound and ATP unbound states, can you show that it doesn't move in your simulation? Obviously, ATP may not be the we can do it, but...
So Gita balance doesn't hold in this model because, one reaction here is ATP, it depends on the concentration of ATP.
Right, so you hold...
If we are taking that away, then we should come to sanctuary. It would be deeply ashamed if that wouldn't happen.
Yes. I should also make one. I mentioned this partly because we have some related work in a master's thesis of my student, which we're just writing up, on a model which is quite similar, which I'm going to talk about on Thursday. So I was shocked.
Okay, so I would be glad to share our paper. We just submitted two papers, one on the quantum chemistry side and one on the modeling side and stochastic model side, and I'm glad to share it with you.
Are there sequence effects on the interaction with the PCR and with the DNA sequence that would appear here?
Are there other
sequence? From your model, you might expect that probably whether A or B units bind more strongly.
That's a good point. So I think I asked to take him when he dies. But he knows these things better than I don't know.
Simulation,
did you see that? No, in simulation. In simulation, your experiment probably think that. Since it's only theory, it's all done in half a day. But they take months and months and months of time and huge computer power. And this is only for me really like to see carefully through the system. I put the whole structure together, but I have to wait for the supercomputer time. The most important part is happening in my brain, but I have to wait for the supercomputer time to really do it. So, that's a nice point that I will keep in mind. That we might look also on how base specific it is. At the moment, actually, we took a poly A model just to make it sort of clear that we can communicate easily what we actually did. But we might want to look at sequence dependence of some of the features, and then that could actually also be thank you very much. That could be a nice point of seeing also. And connection experiment, maybe we see certain mobilities are actually sequence dependent. Thank you. Now I see the depths of your question.
Some of these reactions are exothermic, some are endothermic. This might be important. Do you see ways of putting this into the MP simulation? Release of heat, instantaneous release of heat?
No, I don't think so, because heat dissipates very, very quickly in the system. So if you take a protein of the size of this PCRA, and let's say you put surround it by a spherical shell and you reduce the temperature by 100 degrees, it equilibrates in the domain within about 30 picoseconds. And that's a very short time, even on the modeling time. So heat goes through the system very quickly, and you couldn't really grease, for example, the motion by locally heating it, like in the Bunsen burner, that heat would be all the
time. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So I think the only event that is really driven by some kind of force, where energy plays a role, is that when you bind ATP, many people think that is a technical name. That involves energy, like you pull the system together, a power stroke. But all the other steps are really entropy driven. You turn the system, make one piece more mobile, and the other side more mobile. And so I think this is how nature, who has to do everything within a few kT, otherwise a protein would break, is doing the trick. Like when it binds it, it can pull the domains together a little bit. But from then on, it has to use principles that are not storing any form of energy, they're just controlling the system in an entropic sense.
So everything you've talked about here is about the translocation. But of course, this is also unwinding the DNA. Mm-hmm. Do you have any plans to look at the coupling of the translocation to the unwinding?
That was beautifully done by by Frank Jülicher and a young lady in Texas.
No, that would be me.
That would be you. I was afraid that it was you. I was afraid it was you. That's why I stopped. Okay. So I think you did a very nice job. And so I think, you know, like if we push it mechanically, I don't think we would get more insight than that you got through your mathematical descriptions. So I think we left. You did it. You cleaned the field. Okay, nice meeting you, actually.
Thank you.
Okay.